Hello.
Hello.
I got two free smartphones when I switched to Metro PCS.
One for him and one for me.
It's not for you. It's for people like me.
And parrots.
I knew I should have gotten a dog.
Get two free Samsung Galaxy J3 Prime smartphones when you switch two lines to Metro PCS and enjoy a 4G LTE network that's more reliable than ever before. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network are active on Metro PCS in past 90 days. See store for details, terms, and conditions.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show, I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Walker, see back the brakes in the gate. Pull without a face.
Hello, everyone around the world. Once again, this is Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson, and we are with you this Thursday morning, 12 a.m., 12:08 a.m. Eastern Time here, April 20th, 2017. We'll be with you for the next 2 hours here on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And we have a great show for you, as always. We're supposed to be joined by Cody Gibson. He's supposed to be calling in any moment now. He's finishing up his practice. And he is the Tachi Palace Fighting Championship, Bantamweight Champion. This is a guy who's a big 135er. He's looking to, in the past, looking to fight in a few different weight classes. He's a UFC veteran, relatively young fighter. And he's going to be here on Carson's Corner to discuss his career. And anything else he's got going on at the present time or he anticipates in the future. So it's going to be a great, great interview. We have a lot of MMA news and a lot of stuff that, we have to talk about that happened since our last show last week. Of course, we want to thank Jeff Meyer. He was on the program last week, CEO of Tough Enough, and Rafion Stotts, who became, you saw this, Rafion Stotts became the Victory Fighting Championship, Bantamweight Champion, defeating Rob Emerson in a good fight. No damage did Rafion take. It looked like he just controlled the fight wherever it went. And Rob Emerson, as we've noted, has taken really no damage whatsoever really throughout his career. And so it's not surprising at all that that fight ended the way it did, which was Rafion Stotts getting a unanimous decision at Victory Fighting Championship 56. Big thanks to Rafion, and he'll be in the UFC for sure. It was really, really good to see him fight, and our buddy Rob Emerson as well put on a very, very good fight there. It just was one or two steps behind, you know, with whatever, with striking. He seemed a little hesitant, and Rafion was able to get the takedown really at will. And so that was last week's show. And, you know, last weekend, you, of course, had the UFC on Fox. Wilson Hayes versus Demetrius Johnson. It's funny how I said Wilson Hayes first, right? You know, Demetrius Johnson, which is something I'll get into as far as, you know, the greatest of all time. Tying Anderson Silva's record for title defenses, although technically Anderson got credit versus Travis Luter, where Travis Luter couldn't make weight. Anderson Silva won that via submission. It didn't count as a title fight. And, you know, I had an opportunity to see this. You know, I had
I can't hear you, Bob. Let me try something.
Hello? Hello? Try one more thing. Hello? Yeah, I can't hear anything. Hello?
Get over here!
Because the baby's life has been revoked. The bond is broke. Got so choke up and foe. Kiss on the clothes of Miss Owens. I can't reform. No God like Hogan's focus. So don't sit back, kick back, and watch the world get bushed. Whack you dead, and your neighborhood is under attack. Put away the crack before the crack put you away. You need to be there when your baby's old enough to relay.
So don't you lay. Follow the mix, see you tomorrow, but if
questions we have as we grow. It's hard to find answers to what we don't know. But sometimes there's someone to whom we can turn to teach us life lessons and to help us to learn just what's important and what matters most, much more than our teacher. And we call them coach. Right there to guide us when we need a hand. They reach deep inside us and help us to stand. To lead by example in words and in and show us the courage we need to succeed. And I stand before you, and I'm proud to boast. I'm one of the many who's learned from the travel, the choices you make,
choices you make,
the load that you carry, the chances you take. We raise our glasses and offer this toast to one who will always be known.
Out loud and clear, and I hope we got our connection issues resolved. We're trying to connect with Cody Gibson, who's been calling into the program, and I don't know what the problem is. Our internet connection is fine. I know we were having problems with the internet connection beforehand, and I really don't know. I mean, I got a different connection now. We're able to go online. We're having no problem surfing the web. We've got a solid internet connection. Blog Talk Radio appears to be working okay. So I don't know what the hell the problem is, but hopefully we'll get connected with Cody and bring him on the show as soon as possible. I was talking about beforehand, I don't know if this came on the air or not, about this alleged fight fixing in South Korea. Going back to UFC Fight Night 79, this is pretty interesting because the South Korean investigators, authorities, are investigating a fight between Tae Hyun Bang and Leo Kuntz about fight fixing. And apparently... the Korean fighter already admitted to telling the police after receiving death threats from organized crime figures that he was offered a bribe in the amount of I think it was $87,000. This seems to now have been confirmed, even though initially he denied this. Now, you know, he's saying that he was offered a bribe and he felt threatened and didn't admit at the time, but he told his police his role. And this is very, very interesting because this is the first formal inquiry to fight fixing involved in the UFC. We know that the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, is very close to the gambling industry. We know Station Casinos, which is a company that was owned by Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta. They were the principal owners in that company, and the UFC continues to be headquartered in Las Vegas, and there's just betting all around. Dana White, you know, openly has talked about betting, and these guys, you know, they're involved with gambling. There's no question about it. The Fertitta brothers, Frank Fertitta Sr., I believe. So this is nothing new, but there had never been any type of formal allegation or never been any type of real indication that there was fight fixing involved. Now, I don't think the UFC would openly be involved or be involved with anything like this. I don't think the UFC, you know, would just be absolutely just stupid for them to do that. I mean, these are guys, Dana White is just mind-bogglingly rich. There's been no indication that they would encourage or have participated in fight fixing. And even prior to this fight, the UFC actually was warning both fighters because of the odd swing that they saw in the last minute, in the lead up to this fight. They told both of these guys that if you don't go out there and fight, that you're going to be investigated. And Bang reportedly was told not to leave the country after the fight because of this investigation. There is a lot more details to come out about this. He apparently, like I said, initially denied any type of bribe was made to him. And then he decided to change his mind and decided to talk after the UFC official spoke to him. And it doesn't appear that Kuntz had any indication about what was going on. Didn't appear that he knows or knew anything as far as what was surrounding the fight. Because he said, quote, "When I fought him, I had absolutely no reason to think he wasn't fighting. He flash KO'd me. From what I could tell, it seemed like he was trying to win that fight." But the problem lies for Bang, and it looks like he was in violation of South Korean law, and you know, he could experience repercussions down the road and whatnot. There's really, really, this appears to be an isolated incident. This fight was the only fight on the card that did not end in a TKO or KO. It was just, this is where the investigators kind of, and everybody kind of looked at this fight because everything else ended, in a KO. And it's really, really unfortunate, but this is the risk that you have when you run shows globally. You know, I'm not saying that South Korea is a corrupt country. This is indicative of the behavior that exists in South Korea. I mean, there's organized crime everywhere you go, all across the globe. But by all accounts, you know, South Korea is definitely a country that has been on the rise over the last several decades or so. And this is something I was talking about yesterday
on my political show. So it appears to be isolated, and I would hope that the South Korean officials get to the bottom of this. And I would hope that the UFC continues to monitor betting activity and look at any potential fight fixing or any potential undue influence going forward. It's best for them to police themselves rather than create a scandal, rather than have a scandal that exists that could potentially jeopardize the sport of mixed martial arts, which is not necessarily on solid ground at this point. So that was something that kind of broke over the last couple of days or so. You know, it was kind of unfortunate to see that. But I want to talk a little bit about the UFC fight night. The UFC fight night that took place, or actually UFC on Fox Sports 1, that took place last weekend in Kansas City, Missouri, because just some take-home messages and some further implications, divisions within the UFC. This was one of the lowest-rated cards, lowest-rated events on Fox Sports 1. I forget what the overnight rating was, but it was something like 1.82, with the main event featuring Demetrius Johnson versus Wilson Hayes. And everybody expected Demetrius Johnson to win. This marked, I believe, he surpassed Anderson Silva's record for most consecutive title defenses. Although Anderson Silva, if you look at his fight, if you look at his streak, he actually beat Travis Luter, who didn't make weight. So Anderson Silva's consecutive title defense run should have been 11, not 10. But, it's just a formality. Pair and contrast the careers of Anderson Silva and Demetrius Johnson, and ask who is the greatest of all time, who is was the most dominant champion of all time. I think clearly it was Anderson Silva. You know, Demetrius Johnson has to fight people above his weight. He has to go up and fight, heavier opponents like Anderson Silva did when he was champion to really be considered the best. But nonetheless, it was a dominant performance by Demetrius Johnson over a very, very good, well-rounded opponent who hadn't had a lot of knockouts, but was still very, very good and aggressive, and everywhere he was good. That was obviously the main event. And, flyweights, guys that are not capable of doing a lot of damage, people joking about Demetrius Johnson on the forum, saying, this guy is basically the size of my girlfriend, why the hell am I going to tune in to watch him fight, this and that. I can understand that to a certain extent. I'm not too particularly fond of seeing 125-pound fighters fight, even 135-pound fighters. I mean, that's okay. There are a lot of exciting guys in that weight division, but, flyweight for me. And then you hit the women's strawweight. Rose Namajunas defeating Michelle Waterson. This was a surprise, I think. I think a lot of people thought that Waterson was going to win after her dominant performance over Paige VanZant. But I got to tell you, in the lead-up to this fight, I was kind of annoyed seeing, and maybe this is probably just me. I mean, I realize I'm probably just being a little bit too cynical here. I was kind of annoyed seeing Michelle Waterson's kid there at the press conference at a lot of the workout and this and that and the other thing. I don't want to see this. I think that if the UFC wants to market these women and use their sexual appeal, which there's nothing wrong with that, to increase viewers, to get more intrigued, to get more of the male audience to watch, then the last thing we need to see is Michelle Waterson's kid. You know, I don't want to see it. Maybe it's me. I don't know. Maybe for you, it doesn't make a difference if their kid is there. But to me, it just looks like, you know, I want to think of these women as just not, you know, mothers or family women or, you know, raising children. I want to think of these women as almost like sex symbols, you know? And so I just didn't like to see that. The Rose Nama Yunus, you know, she's an interesting character. She had her dog there at some of the open workouts, and she was doing some different things. And, you know, she's a pretty interesting character. So that was all right. But the fight itself was really, really good. It was almost reminiscent of when Holly knocked out Ronda, that big head kick that Rose landed, and her being able to put Michelle away there. And now, you know, most likely she'll get a title fight after Joanna and Jacek versus Jessica Andrade. I fully expect Joanna to win that fight. So then you'll have her versus Rose Nama Yunus. And what's interesting is, according to Rose, Joanna has actually taken some shots at her in the media, which suggests, according to Rose, that at least that she's on her mind. So that'll be very, very interesting to see, because I think Rose has a little bit of a deceptive record there at actually 6-3, because if you look at her fights, you know, some of her fights there, she's only lost to really the top girls in the strawweight division. And, you know, she's only really been stopped once, and that was by Carla Esparza, who later went on and fought for the title. So she's really, really a good fighter, and a very, very young fighter, too. She posted a picture on Instagram of her in, like, eighth grade in a street in Milwaukee, you know, her house. And, you know, like, her in eighth grade, that was probably back in 2010 or something like that. You know, it wasn't a picture that was from, like, you know, when I was in eighth grade, or when, you know, most of us were in eighth grade, which is going back to, like, the 1990s. You know, before that or whatever. But she's still very young at 24 years old and still could really, really do a lot in the sport, and is really, really developing. And that's a big, big key. Now, the biggest disappointment for me and the biggest surprise for me was the Robert Whittaker versus Jacare Souza fight, because Robert Whittaker wasn't really supposed to win this fight. I think everybody thought that Jacare was going to win. So, you know, Whittaker defeats him second round, you know, 3 minutes into the second round, was winning the first round pretty handily. Jacare looked slow. He looked old out there. Wasn't able to really get Whittaker on the ground. He got his back at one point, but it was all fundamentals for Robert Whittaker and getting up to the ground and essentially neutralizing Jacare and forcing him to fight a stand-up fight versus himself, who obviously there's a big advantage for Robert Whittaker in the stand-up department. So he defeats Jacare. I thought the fight was stopped a little early, but I don't know if the stoppage would have necessarily negated the end result, which would have been Robert Whittaker victory. Jacare wasn't totally out, but he was definitely losing. You know, what's to say he couldn't have been knocked fully unconscious a minute or two, you know, into the round after that, further into the round. But this really bothers me, because, you know who's happy about this is Michael Bisping. Michael Bisping is happy about this because he doesn't have to fight another top contender who he didn't want to fight in the first place. So now this is just more time for him. It buys him more time to, now he's saying that he wants to fight Whittaker as opposed to Romero. You notice
not more than a couple weeks ago, he said that he would fight Yoel Romero because GSP was taking too long. So the guy doesn't believe anything he says. The guy doesn't stick with anything what he says. He says one thing one day, says another thing another day. The bottom line is he doesn't want to fight top contenders in his division. So the longer, I've said this repeatedly, the longer he has the title and the longer he could keep that title without, better it is for him, because he knows that these guys are going to end up fighting different opponents and he's going to wind up having not to fight anybody he doesn't want to fight in the first place. You know, so it's like, you know, you've got Yoel Romero that's supposed to fight coming up. If he fights Anderson Silva, if he fights this or that guy, or let's say he fights Robert Whittaker, or, you know, maybe Luke Rockhold, I don't know. Well, you know, the odds are, or there's probably a decent chance that something could go wrong for him, Romero. Maybe he wins a lackluster decision. Maybe, you know, he has to pull out. Maybe he gets injured. Maybe his opponent, you know, any number of different factors. Well, that means that Bisping doesn't have to fight him. And Bisping can have more time with the belt and keep that belt without fighting guys that he doesn't want to fight. Okay, yeah, that Whittaker is a tougher fight for Bisping, because Whittaker is not a ground guy. Yoel Romero is a knockout artist, knockout puncher, and a ground guy. He would beat Michael Bisping in a ground fight. I don't think Yoel would go for the takedown. Yoel doesn't really go for takedowns. Yoel's primarily a clubber on the feet. But, you know, Yoel would be a worse matchup for Jacare, I think. And everybody, you know, criticizes Yoel's cardio. Well, look, he doesn't look gassed. He has the stamina, and he's beaten, you know, these guys when everybody said he was gassed. You know, a five-round fight, that's just more opportunity for him to whack Bisping and to get the championship. So I was really, really disappointed, because Michael, Robert Whittaker really threw a monkey wrench into the middleweight division there. And now everybody's saying that, you know, Jacare doesn't get a title shot. He's down the line, this and that. It's a shame. It really is that this belt is not being defended anytime soon. And nobody knows what's happening with George St. Pierre. George St. Pierre has anxiety issues. George St. Pierre definitely has anxiety issues, and he clearly has some anxiety about going up to 185, which is why he hasn't committed to a date. And nobody knows what's going to happen. You know, I mean, anything could happen there. But you know what? This is just how much more gravy can Michael Bisping get from the UFC, and you know, how much more advantages and how much more can the UFC bend over to accommodate Michael Bisping? It's just, to me, it's disgusting. It really is. Yeah, George St. Pierre was actually the first MMA fighter, ladies and gentlemen, to hire a sports psychologist, okay? So that comes from George St. Pierre. And I'm not knocking him. You know, I'm not knocking these guys. There are guys and a lot of girls that have anxiety issues and all that stuff. And I do too, believe me. I'm not a professional fighter, and I have crippling anxiety. You know, so I don't want you to think I'm poking fun at these people. But as a fan, as an analyst, it gets very, very frustrating when you don't see these guys fight because of this. And Michael Bisping has the same anxieties as George St. Pierre. Michael Bisping needs to see a sports psychologist. Okay, I think that would definitely help him. I think he's another guy that he's got problems outside of the ring, too. I think he's just, a loose cannon, Michael Bisping is. Michael Bisping has actually admitted to starting heavily drinking at the age of 15.
And this is a guy who, when you see him all too often on camera outside of the octagon, he's drunk and he's in a confrontation with somebody. So, the UFC and Fox Sports and SiriusXM, they have a real problem, or they could have a problem with him. But you know what? If he loses, then, you almost become irrelevant in the sport very, very quickly. You lose, if he loses the next fight and somebody else gets the belt, he goes to the wayside and almost becomes an afterthought. That's how this sport is. So, so that's, that was my takeaway from last weekend's event in Kansas City, which, as I mentioned, had a very, very low rating there, not surprising. But some of this you gotta think is due to the main event, Demetrius Johnson. There was playoff hockey, I'm sure. You've got the playoffs now in full swing. I don't know which games were playing at the time, but you've got other factors. But, the UFC, as I've said, they're not the number one MMA organization when it comes to television ratings anymore. I think it's a toss-up between them and Bellator. Bellator has become a viable television competitor to the UFC, and they're looking to go now to pay-per-view, which is only going to benefit them, and they're going to be acquiring more UFC fighters out there. UFC fighters are still very, very disappointed about, their pay and their promotion, and it's anybody's guess as far as whether or not they get that the same amount of pay from Bellator, because it's really, really difficult. Bellator and the UFC, I realize, are two organizations, but separate organizations. But if you look at someone like CM Punk, who got $500,000 to fight Mickey Gall, then he got an extra $500,000 for pay-per-view points, which made it $1 million. Bellator, to my knowledge, has not had $1 million payout for fighters. Now, the thing about Bellator, which they could really, really, to fighters that want to come over, is that fighters in Bellator can make more money off sponsorships, obviously, than they can at the UFC, where the UFC doesn't allow sponsors. It's Reebok and that's it. In the UFC, fighters are losing a lot of money with sponsorships due to Reebok. So, Bellator, I would have to say you'd probably make less money at Bellator just by looking at the actual fight purse. But the potential to make more money there with sponsorships exists. And I don't think Bellator has any other, they're going to start offering pay-per-view points, but they don't have any pay-per-view, point structure now. And the merchandise, other ways to make money, I don't really think the fighters can make money really off of any other things, but it's still very, very early in the game. I'm going to take a brief time out here. We may try to reach out to Cody Gibson and see if we can try to get him on. If not, then I'll just have to continue on. We've got some other news here. You've got Conor McGregor just really partying and apparently living a very, very lavish lifestyle where there could be drugs involved. I'll explain after the break. And you've got Jerry Millen. Jerry Millen may be out of Risen Fighting Federation. I want to talk a little bit about that here on Carson's Corner. So keep it right here, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson, ladies and gentlemen.
Public life.
on Carson's Corner, and we're going to try to connect now to Cody Gibson. Hopefully we get through, and hopefully we're not having any more technical problems here. Cody, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. I'm so sorry for the difficulties there. I think we're having problems on my end with the internet and everything. How are you doing today, man?
I'm doing good. Let me step outside. I got a sleeping baby inside, so
but yeah, you just got to get out of practice. You must be feeling pretty tired, I imagine. What is it, like 9, 10 o'clock over there where you're at?
Yeah, 10 o'clock. Later where you're at, though, right?
Yeah, it's like 1 o'clock. I'm a night owl. See, I'm on unemployment now, and so my nights and days are mixed up. I mean, I literally woke up probably only 5 or 6 hours ago, which is insane. So, like, I'll be up all night. Yeah, but listen, you know, we really appreciate you calling in and hanging in there. Many people know you from your UFC, but you're also on a very, very good winning streak and established yourself as the Tachi Palace Fighting or Palace Fights Bantamweight Champion, which I definitely want to talk about. You've been involved with wrestling from a very early stage in your life. From what I understand, that's what really stuck out for me when I was reading your biography on some of the MMA record sites that we found. That you also, though, were apparently adopted when you were a small child. And I know that that's probably very difficult, affects different people in different ways, and it could be a sensitive subject. But is there anything that you'd be comfortable sharing about that?
Yeah, I'm not it's not sensitive for me. Yeah, it was me and my older brother Keith were adopted 1989. I was 2 years old. He was 3 years old, and yeah, we came to California from Oklahoma. So we've been out here ever since. Yeah, we just got really, really fortunate, kind of luck of the draw. We had a foster parent who was an elderly lady who went to a hearing aid place in Oklahoma, and the person who ran the hearing aid place happened to be my adopted parents, my adopted dad's aunt. And my adopted parents couldn't have kids for like 10, 15 years. They tried and tried and tried and couldn't conceive. And so back then, adoption was a lot easier, you know. But long story short, we ended up in California, and we've been here ever since.
Yeah, that seems like a good story, because many people get adopted, end up in a much, much better situation. And a lot of times it's a very, very positive thing. Now, you mentioned you moved to California. What is it like out there? I mean, it seems like certain parts of California can be very relaxed, and then many parts of the states are, you know, they're pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, I've been all over California. I've lived in the Bay Area, but I've grown up and I moved back to, after college, the Central Valley, which is a lot more of a laid-back agricultural area. Almost, it's a lot, in a lot of ways, like the Midwest and Oklahoma. You know, a lot of the, I'm a history guy, so, you know, during the Dust Bowl, a lot of the people from Oklahoma migrated to the Central Valley. Because it was so similar, at least in terms of what kind of jobs were available to them and what their skills were. So yeah, it's a pretty, you know, the biggest cities around me are Fresno and Bakersfield. I live in a city called Visalia. It's about 150,000 people, which seems like a lot, but in California city terms, it's pretty small. So, you know, pretty small town atmosphere here. And, I kind of like that.
Yeah, you know, it seems like one could say that Cali is the mecca of MMA in this country. I mean, it seems like so much of the sport's early roots were set down there with the underground fights and many capable fight teams. You know, they've also got a pretty active wrestling scene, from what I could tell. And I know that you got involved with that fairly early. How did you end up becoming a wrestler?
I ended up becoming a wrestler because I was 5'4" as a high school freshman and didn't make the basketball team. So my older brother, who's a little bit smaller than me, actually, he was a 112 pounder in high school, 103s and 112s. And he encouraged me. You know, I was pretty bummed out because I really enjoyed basketball when I was really younger. And he'd been wrestling for quite a few years already. And, you know, he just encouraged me to try wrestling. And literally, first day on the mat, once I got my feet wet in it, kind of fell in love with the sport and ended up being the only sport I played in high school and went on to college and wrestled for 5 years. It became a big part of my life ever since then.
Yeah, you actually took that pretty far at the collegiate level, and that stuck with, and then you stuck with it, whereas, you know, some people get tired and quit. But before that, you were wrestling in high school. What was that like? Because it seems like different schools treat wrestling differently. You know, I know some schools where the wrestling team is very dedicated and even successful, but the other students still think of it as a niche sport and really don't understand the sport. Then there are the other schools where wrestling is, you know, highly valued and the wrestlers themselves get a lot of respect and admiration.
Yeah, my high school, I would say, was the former, not the latter, of those two descriptions. We didn't really have – our coach was actually a football coach who had never even wrestled. He had taken up the position, and he was a really good, you know, coach, like, as far as organization and management. But he didn't really, you know a lot of technical wrestling. He was a big guy, too. He was a heavyweight. So me and my brother pretty early on realized that in order to be successful, we needed to, you know, branch out during the off season and wrestle in the off season, not only wrestle in the off season, but learn how to wrestle. Cause we're lighter weight guys. And as you know, even in fighting, the lighter weights tend to be, the more technical. So me and my brother, I remember in high school, you know, selling beef jerky sticks all year so we can afford to go to wrestling camp or go to Fargo Nationals or the National Duels and for Team California, whatever, you know, we were getting ready for that summer. We would just fundraise all year and go to camps and different things like that. And that's really where we got a lot of our early wrestling and learned how to really the technical side of the wrestling.
You were very successful as a junior collar wrestler, reaching All-American status more than once, I believe. Was there something which clicked at that stage that helped you reach that level?
I think really it was more than anything. I'm going to be 30 years old this year, so I feel like I've been wrestling forever. But I was, I was a freshman in high school when I started. And here in the Central Valley, we have some of the best teams in the state, some of the best teams in the country, Clovis High School, Bakersfield High School. Competing against those guys when I've only been wrestling a couple of years, it wasn't really until my junior and then a lot more in my senior year that I started really having success. And so by the time I graduated, I think I was just a little bit behind the curve as far as, I was wrestling guys that had been wrestling since they were 5, 6 years old. And so I think once I got into junior college is when I really started to progress. I think it showed as far as, getting on the podium.
Yeah, absolutely. You wrestled at Menlo College, which I understand is a business orientation. At that stage, I think it seems like you were focusing more or less on your academics. And then you wrestled at the same time. How did you manage to balance both of those aspects, the academic aspect of college and, of course, wrestling?
To be honest, the academic side of it has always kind of been easier for me. For me, it was more of the maturity side that I lacked. I moved away from home at 17, and when I got up to the Bay Area, I just wasn't even. I went to junior college about an hour away from my hometown, but I was still pretty focused on wrestling. By the time I got to San Francisco area, I just you know, I mean, I wrestled for 3 years up there, and I did pretty well my senior year and put in some more effort and energy into it. But those first couple of years I was up there, you know, I think I was just too young and immature to really embrace the opportunity, you know. And I think the regret I had from my time in my, you know, my 3 years at Menlo really is what fueled me to focus, you know, when I got out of school. That those regrets are what really fueled me as far as, you know, I knew I had more to give athletically, and MMA, you know, just like so many wrestlers, it just lended itself to an opportunity to do that. So I think in the grand scheme of things, it was a blessing. But at the time, you know, looking back on it, it was really just a lack of maturity on my part.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that's right around the time when you started to get involved with mixed martial arts. And when you got into mixed martial arts, you seem to be just a pure wrestler with no real specialized striking or submission training. Is that a correct or a fair assessment of where you were at that time?
Yeah, my first three fights, I actually had no training whatsoever. I was just a wrestler who liked to fight, and I was getting in fights anyway, so I might as well get paid a few hundred bucks to do it. And so I literally had never thrown a punch on a bag or a mitt or done any jiu-jitsu, anything. I just was going out there and trying to blast double them and swinging for the fences. But, yeah, that's kind of how I got started.
Who was it that introduced you to the sport?
I mean, I remember, you know, even back in high school, my dad would rent the UFCs from Blockbuster. And that's really how we were a big, me and my brothers were big pro wrestling fans as kids, the Hulk Hogan and Macho Man. I was a big Ultimate Warrior fan. And so we were always into that. And then when we started getting those DVDs from Blockbuster, and, you know, as we got older and realized that the pro wrestling wasn't actually real, you know, once those DVDs came out, suddenly we our interest kind of shifted from the WWF stuff to the UFC stuff. But really, actually, it was a friend of mine from high school who was training, and he had quite a few fights back in the day. And he just invited me one day. I was home for the summer, invited me to a gym to try out some jiu-jitsu, and then that's what kind of got me started in it.
Did you want to train in submissions and striking and not have the opportunity, or did you just figure you just wing it and see how it went for the time being?
I mean, I just remember not really understanding any of it. I think I was a little, I think when I first started, I was a little bit, I won't say conceited, but I was big-headed. You know, I thought wrestling, you know, I saw guys like Randy Couture and Mark Coleman and these guys, and those back in the day, I mean, they were primarily just wrestlers too, you know? And so I just figured I can go out and use my wrestling. And I was still wrestling in college, so I had no, like, real goal or ambition at first to pursue an actual long-term career in MMA. I was just doing it literally because they were like, we'll pay you $200 to show up and $200 more if you win. And so to me, you know, 22 years old, 21, 20 years old, sounded like big money to me. So at first it wasn't really that I wasn't interested in them. I was just kind of, you know, flying by the seat of my pants, I think.
What was it like getting in there as a pure wrestler? I mean, you must have had a pretty strong will to fight and find a way to win with just your wrestling experience to go on.
Yeah, I mean, I had a long history of getting into fights in school. And, you know, as I got older, you know, the bar scene and all that, I got into a lot of fights. So I knew I liked to fight. So to me, I approached it as just another fight. You know, I wasn't you talk to some of these guys that are, you know, really into the martial arts side of it. And as I've gotten more involved over the years, you know, I've become more of a martial artist as well. But at first, it was a street fight to me in a cage where people watched us. But other than that, that was kind of my approach toward it at first, for sure.
Now, did those fights come before your official debut with Tachi Palace Fights?
My second and third. No, my first pro fight was at a Gladiator Challenge event, and then my second and third fight was at the Tachi Palace. Back then,
okay.
It was called the PFC, Palace Fighting Championship. But, you know, the Tachi Palace is has a long history. I mean, that's where the WEC actually started. Uriah Faber fought there. Nate Diaz fought there. A lot of guys back when it was the WEC. So, I mean, yeah, I've been at the Tachi Palace off and on my whole career. It's about 35 minutes from my hometown, so.
Yeah, and, you know, even though you didn't have a lot of training and striking, I mean, you were still beating guys by TKO, which is very impressive. Were you essentially trapping them with wrestling and then striking for the finish, or was it a case of you having some natural power on your feet?
I don't think it was much talent on my feet. I think, you know, I just wasn't afraid to strike. I think sometimes you see wrestlers that are so desperate to get the fight to the ground that it becomes they're telegraphing their takedowns. And
right.
For me, I remember I wasn't afraid to go out and swing with a guy. I didn't necessarily know what I was doing, but I wasn't afraid to get hit or to hit them and get in the pocket with them. And then sometimes I think that helps lend to the takedown. Back then, you know, because the guy's so focused on what's going on with your hands, you know, they walk into takedowns. But primarily it was just that. It was getting a guy. The game plan early on every single time was take him down and then just beat on him.
How much experience with fighting did you have before you started to do professional? I mean, you mentioned you fought a lot. Did you get into a lot of scraps at the high school and college level?
Yeah, I did. The elementary school, junior high school, and college. I remember in college I had a roommate in junior college who was a little bit older than me who had one professional fight. And, you know, one Saturday night we invited everyone over for a party and the main attraction was going to be me fighting my roommate. We put on the MMA gloves and we had a you know, an unsanctioned fight in the backyard. We put some ropes up and, yeah, so I was always getting into scuffles, I think, most of my life. I was a pretty aggressive kid, so, you know, that dates all the way back to elementary school, really.
Yeah, you actually had a high-profile street fight that I wanted to ask you about in a few moments. But before we get to that, I want to talk about how you hooked up with a legitimate MMA team and really rounded out your game. You started off with Tony Knox when you first started training, or was he a coach who came later?
Tom Knox came after I graduated from college. My first three fights, I would just come home in the summertime and take a fight. And I didn't really have a gym I was training at. And the only established gym in my area was Tom Knox gym. He's the only black belt around, at the time, especially. And he had started his jiu-jitsu gym and it kind of morphed into a mixed martial arts gym. And then, Doug the Rhino Marshall, who was the former WEC champion. And then, he won one of the Bellator tournaments as well. He was the Muay Thai coach. And they started, you know, producing some decent fighters and building a reputation in the local scene. And so when I graduated from college and moved back home, that's when I decided to go check out that gym. And I was only three fights into my career at the time, so I hadn't had too much experience. But I've been with them ever since. I was in 2010, so it's over about 7 years ago.
Yeah, Doug the Rhino. He really fought in Bellator. Many people remember him for his knockouts. He's definitely something of a wild man. I mean, he seems like a very intense individual, one of the last people anyone would want to mess with on the street or in the cage. What was it like training with Doug?
Doug's actually, you know, calmed down quite a bit over the years. And he's actually he was the first ever American black belt for Rafael Cordero. So he's actually a very technical Muay Thai fighter. Sometimes I think, you know, he loves to be in the pocket and swing. So sometimes doesn't seem like he's as technical as he really is, but he's a good coach, and he knows how to break things down, and he's very technical in the gym. But yeah, when I first started training with him, he was still pretty wild. You know, his personality kind of matched his fighting style. He was pretty wild. But again, that was 7 years ago. And over the years, you know, I just got done with him. We were just training together tonight. And it's like a night and day, you know, a completely different human being today as opposed to back then.
Were there any intense or wild moments in between you guys when you were training?
Well, we used to spar together back in the day, and I don't remember why we would spar together, but we did. I'm a 135 pounder, and he walks around over 200 pounds. And I remember I would just jab, and run around the room, and just try to use my speed against him. And if he would just box with me, I could go with him because I was faster. I could move, and just watch out for his big power punches. But then he would want to, of course, put on the shin pads and do some kicks too. And once I ate a few of his leg kicks, I was done fighting kickboxing or Muay Thai with him. I can only take one of his kicks or two of his kicks before I'm on the ground. So that kind of was the end of that.
Do you have any stories about the Rhino that you could share without getting arrested? I think the statute of limitations will have expired.
You know what? I'll share just a good one. Doug's he'll be the first to admit that he struggled with alcohol and things like that over the years. And mm-hmm. you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, he's quit drinking, and he's a father. His son's in high school. He's actually wrestled in high school, and really changed a lot in a lot of good ways. So Doug's still a kid at heart. He's got more toys than anybody else I know. He's got a wakeboarding boat and a Harley Davidson motorcycle and everything under the sun, but he's a good dude.
At what point would you say you were starting to round out and become a full MMA fighter and not just a wrestler? I mean, was this when you were, you know, beating guys like Watson, Wallell Watson, and entering the UFC, or did it come at a certain point beforehand?
No, I think it really came after him. The first fight, I actually felt really comfortable in my technical ability in my stand-up, was probably against Ulysses Gomez. And Ulysses at the time was a guy who was known for having a really good ground game. And so it was really the first fight I had where my game plan was to not go to the ground. I felt like I could outstrike him. And so it was the first fight I ever had where the whole training camp was designed around me using my wrestling in, you know, the Chuck Liddell way, defend the takedown and force him to strike with me. And that was kind of the first time I realized that I was really making some leaps and bounds in my striking. And and moving forward from there, about 3 years ago, I met a guy named Eloy Garza, who's been my boxing coach ever since. And ever since I started working with Eloy about 3 years ago, I feel like my striking's, if you watch most of my fights nowadays, they're almost entirely on the feet. That's when I feel like I really started making improvements in my striking, about 3 years ago. But dating back to the Ulysses fight is when I first started to really feel some real confidence in my striking ability.
Yeah, that you two had an incredibly tough fight there, and that was for the bantamweight title, and it really seemed like it could have been a good learning experience. And I think he won in the third round, if I'm not mistaken. What was it about that fight that really motivated you to improve? Was there any take-home messages from that fight? Because he's a hell of an athlete and a grappler and whatnot.
Yeah, it was really a good learning experience for me because I stuck to my game plan the first two rounds. I forced him to strike with me, and I was winning. I won the first round, won the second round, and then just kind of had I don't know if it was an adrenaline dump. I've never been that tired in a fight. Usually one of my greatest weapons in fights is my cardio. I'm pretty known at the gym for having an endless gas tank. And I don't know if it was just not being used to striking for multiple rounds and just completely on the feet or what it was, but that third round I just dived and ended up, you know, abandoning my game plan and reverting back to what I was used to, which was shooting in for a takedown. And I walked right into one of his patented guillotines. So it was a good learning experience for me. And it definitely, I think it built some confidence that I did have some skills in the striking department. And then, you know, just learning that, you know, how to stay relaxed in a fight and, you know, and not get too overhyped. I remember I sprinted to the cage in that fight. And I came right after him those first two rounds and beat him those first two rounds of the striking. And then it all kind of just came to a crash two rounds too early, you know.
Now, after those fights, you went on a very successful six-fight undefeated run. Was there something which happened in your life, training or mindset, which allowed you to put it together and go on that kind of a hot streak?
I think starting at some point in that six fight win streak is when I started working with my boxing coach, who's really my head striking coach now. And I think that was probably a turning point, but also just having the experiences I had. You know, I was never a guy on the local scene who turned down fights. I fought anybody they put in front of me. And so I did have a couple of losses early on in my career, not necessarily because I was getting beat by somebody who's better than me, but I just was fighting guys with more experience than I had who had been doing it longer. And so I think those experiences sometimes, you know, when you lose, it's like the world's crashing, you know, and then
yeah,
it takes time. But when you look back on them, especially early on in your career, and you start to really, you know, you really take things from those fights and learn from them. I think that's what kind of contributed to, going on a nice little streak to get into the UFC.
Now, during that run, you defeated the very tough Andrew Whitney and Chad George, who has always been one of the best grapplers at that weight class. Can you tell us a little about each of those two fights and what came together against someone with only one loss like the Beast Whitney first?
Yeah, the Andrew Whitney fight was actually for Titan Fighting Championship back when it was on Access TV. It was on the Access TV circuit, same as like the RFA and Legacy and stuff like that. And it was in Kansas City, and I really was brought in there to lose. You know, Andrew Whitney was training with the Black Zillions, but he was from that area, and you know, I was brought into that fight to lose. And you know, I was able to exploit some of his weaknesses on the ground. And I even had some success in the striking as well. So that was a big turning point. It was the first time I ever fought on national television. And that was the second of those six wins. And then I just kept the ball rolling after that.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you train specifically, though, for the Chad George fight? I mean, you ended up fighting him and submitting him in the first round. And he's obviously a very, very formidable opponent. How did you train for Chad George, and what did you expect in that fight? And how did you end up, you know, making it all come together and getting a first-round finish like that?
With Chad George, it was the first time I'd ever fought a southpaw. And so, you know, it was a little bit different, you know, fighting a southpaw. It's completely different strategy. I mean, I don't put too much emphasis on what my opponent does, but you've got to address that in training, that there's going to be some different strategies fighting a southpaw. And I knew, you know, at the time Chad George had been in the WEC, he was a veteran. I think I was actually one of his last fights. I think he fought maybe one or two times after our fight and retired. So I knew the fight could go anywhere. It was one of those, he was a well-rounded mixed martial artist who was good everywhere. So I couldn't just have a very, you know, strict game plan of how I wanted the fight to go. And it did go everywhere. He actually tried to hit a darts choke on me And it was really tight, and I just refused to tap out. And luckily, I was able to keep enough separation to in my windpipes to keep from passing out. And he pretty much gassed his arms out trying that darts choke. And then after that, his arms were done, and I just went after him and ended up getting a guillotine and finishing him with the guillotine.
Yeah, that definitely was a highlight reel fight and finish, no question about that. And then not too long after that, you got called up to fight in the UFC, and Aljamain Sterling, as we've seen, is an absolute beast and a very hard combination of skill and physical attributes to face. How did you feel going into your UFC debut? You know, what was the pressure like, and what were you expecting from Sterling?
Well, I mean, it happened so fast. I got the fight on, I think, 10 days' notice. So I think that was kind of a good thing because I didn't really have time to digest too much.
Uh-huh.
I pretty much I talked to a few UFC fighters that I knew to kind of get me prepared for what it was going to be like. The fight was in Vegas. I believe it was at the Mandalay Bay. And I didn't know much about Sterling. I knew he was from the East Coast. I knew he was a tall, lanky kid. I knew he was a wrestler. So I didn't really have any specific game plan with him. I was confident, you know, but again, it's on 10 days notice. You know, I was in halfway decent shape, but I definitely wasn't ready, you know, in fight shape.
Right.
The biggest challenge for me and the main focus was making weight because I'm a big bantamweight. I walk around about 160 to 165 pounds. So I had to lose 30 plus pounds in 10 days. And that was really the challenge, but luckily we were able to make the weight and put on a good fight. It was a close fight. So.
Yeah, you actually did very well in that fight, even though it didn't go your way. I mean, as we've seen them arguably be contenders on the roster and absolutely crush fighters like Mizugaki and Eduardo, who had significantly more experience than you did at the time. You followed that up with I think, one of your biggest wins to date over the very dangerous Johnny Bedford. And there was a mild element of controversy. Some people, especially Johnny, felt that the referee stepped in a little bit early, but there was no question that you had hurt very badly in the very first round. How do you recall that fight playing out from your perspective, and what were your thoughts on the stoppage at the time?
Well, Johnny, like you said, he's a super dangerous guy. He hits really hard for a bantamweight, probably the hardest bantamweight I've ever fought as far as his punching power. And he hit me with a liver shot early on in the fight, and then he just came in with a flying knee with his hands down, and I blocked the knee and then just came over the top of the right hand, and his body went limp, and he went to the canvas. And as I came in to hammer fist to finish the fight, the ref jumped in, and then I stopped and looked at the ref, and the ref jumps out because Johnny wakes up. And it was just kind of a weird – if the ref had just jumped into that moment, at the you know, and not hesitated and jumped out, I don't think there would have been any controversy because of the way his body went limp and he fell. But the way the referee kind of second-guessed himself and jumped in and then jumped out, it just made it awkward. And it was really unfortunate because – you know, it was my first UFC win, and it was kind of spoiled by the whole thing. And then Johnny, of course, I'm not a big fan of his personality. You know, we kind of got into it in the back after the fight as well, and he's a guy that it seems to always have controversy surrounding him. So, you know, it was kind of disappointing in the fact that there wasn't any controversy with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the fight game, I guess.
Well, what happened? Why would he be upset at you? I mean, I can understand why the referee moved in for the stoppage based on the way he fell. I mean, he fell very stiff and was clearly out as he was going down. I mean, he may have woken up when he hit the mat, but then you'd be coming at him with a very solid wrestling game and more power shots would be on the way. So, you know, what happened backstage? Like, why? What was his problem with you?
Just his kind of attitude is, you know, he was just getting in my face and almost wanted to fight in the back. They had to separate us because I just don't really stand for that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
You know, it was what it was, but, you know, his attitude was definitely, he felt like he got robbed or whatever, you know. But at the end of the day, I won, he lost. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you showed you had the power to hurt people at 135, which not everyone has. And afterwards, you took on one of the finalists from perhaps the most talented ever season of The Ultimate Fighter, Manny Gambarian. I think most people expected you to get the win in that one after how quickly you took up Bedford, but he was able to revitalize his career with an excellent performance. In fact, you were looking absolutely great in the first round of that fight. It seemed like you were able to bust him up with the jab, and then when he got inside, you either were stuffing the takedown, muscling him around, or landing hard elbows and knees. It looked like the start of your finest performance in the cage to date. How did you feel in the first round against Manny?
I mean, I felt good. I felt like, you know, I feel like I'm a tall bantamweight, and, you know, you see a lot of guys in MMA especially who don't really know how to use their reach and their length effectively. In boxing, you see, you know, people understand distance and range so much better. And I feel like for MMA, I understand how to use my reach effectively. And with Manny, you know, he's a short, compact dude. He throws looping punches. And I knew all that going into that fight, so I really wanted to stay at range and use my long jab to frustrate him, force him to shoot shots from the outside, which are easy to stuff. And everything was going according to game plan, you know. Unfortunately, you know, he got in a scramble, and I was actually good. He went for a guillotine toward the end of the fight, and I was actually good at first, and then I made a mistake, and because I felt confident, oh, I'm good in this position, I tried to kind of shimmy my way out of the guillotine, and he actually locked it in tighter, and I didn't realize the time was almost out for the round, but I was going to sleep, and I ended up tapping right before I fell asleep. So, you know, it was another one of those kind of similar to the Ulysses Gomez fight where just a mental lapse, and, you know, I took it for a learning experience, you know. But, yeah, up until then, everything was going according to plan. But, again, that's a fight game. You know, I think that's one of the things that makes it so exciting is that things could be going so well 1 minute, and then flip of a switch, everything turns upside down. So,
I mean, in the second round, it looked like you were close to finishing him. And, again, you know, seemed to be beating the heck out of him with punches. It really looked like you were dominating him. The way almost nobody has. Then late in the round, you know, as you were saying, he managed to find a guillotine somewhere and you got stuck in an awkward position with an arm trapped in and having to tap. That had to have been disappointing because, again, you looked so spectacular in the fight up until that moment and very, very much ready to move up the ladder at 135. Did you have any awareness of how much time was left in the round? I mean, I think there's only like a few seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that it was coming to the end of the round, but I had no idea that the 10-second clapper had already hit. I think I tapped literally like 2 seconds left, but yeah, I just didn't have the awareness, you know. I had no idea, but I was going to sleep, so had I not tapped, the round would have ended, and I might have been unconscious on the floor. So.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Manny is an incredibly powerful guy, especially with his hooked out upper body and chokes and whatnot. We have to talk about this a little because the incident that happened after your fight with Manny, which brought you a lot of different kind of notoriety. I know this is something you're probably embarrassed about, so I don't want to dwell on it too much, but it's definitely something I want to put behind you in terms of your career and your personal life, I'm sure. Right after the Manny fight, you were hanging out in Las Vegas for a while, and you ended up in a video which went viral after you had a verbal altercation with a guy who was trying to provoke you and it ended up in a brief scuffle. It could be called a street fight, but obviously you were holding back. I mean, I think you were trying to exercise some sort of restraint. What happened with that incident?
I mean, my best friend from college actually is from Las Vegas. He wrestled with me in college, and so after the fight, I stayed back. I don't get to see him too often anymore. So I stayed at his house for 3 or 4 days after the fight just to visit with him. And we hung out. And then the last night before I was flying out the next morning, he wanted to take me, according to him, to show me the real Vegas because people that live in Vegas don't really go to the strip like us tourists do. real Vegas is like old Vegas and downtown old Vegas. So, you know, he took me out and we were kind of bar hopping around and he was showing me different, you know, venues that he liked. And we ended up at one and a kind of belligerently drunk guy, one of those kind of buffed up steroid looking dudes, decided I was the guy that he was going to pick a fight with that night. And, you know, looking back on the whole situation, I definitely think I could have handled it better. I could have just gotten out of the situation right off the get-go and kind of read those red flags. But, you know, again, you know, I tend to learn things the hard way. And, you know, it is what it is. I was disappointed in the fact that, you know, the video, once the guy pushed me, you know, I was kind of luckily I didn't throw any punches. I think that saved my job at the time. But, you know, it is what it is. I don't know. You know, it's one of those things.
Well, how much of a factor was alcohol? Because clearly he was intoxicated. And you may have been to a lesser extent, or maybe you just handled it better. I don't know.
Yeah, I wasn't, like, belligerently drunk or anything like that. I mean, I probably had 4 to 6 beers, 4 or 5 maybe. But, you know, I wasn't, like, you know, falling over drunk or anything like that. But, yeah, I mean, maybe had I hadn't had any alcohol, I would have had a clearer head and been able to avert the situation a little better. I'm not going to say that it didn't contribute to what went down, but I don't think that was, like, a huge factor. I mean, you know, my personality, especially as I've gotten older, I'm not finding myself getting into street fights anymore. I haven't been in a street fight since then, actually. That was the last one I was in. But I still, you know, don't appreciate it when somebody disrespects me. And, you know, I stand up for myself. And he disrespected me time and time again, trying to pick a fight with me. So, you know, I think I did learn a lot from that. I haven't been involved in any incidents since then. I've also got a family now, so I'm not going out into environments where I could find myself in those situations anymore very often either. So,
well, you know, part of the reason that it got so much attention was the way you try to convince him that it wasn't a good idea to try and fight you. When you told him I'm a UFC fighter, you also coined something of a phrase when you yelled out, "Google me, bitch," or something to that effect.
Yeah.
What was going through your mind when you said those words?
Well, at first I just told him, I tried to, you know, I don't know why at the time I thought I could talk sense into him, because looking back on it, it probably perpetuated the situation more than anything else. But I told him, listen, dude, I'm a professional fighter. I just fought 3 nights ago at the Mandalay Bay. You know, I don't want to fight you. And then he started telling me I wasn't a UFC fighter. I was full of, you know, shit, essentially. And that's when I uttered the Google me bitch line. And I was just, you know, kind of mouthing off at that point. But, yeah, that's what kind of stuck with that video for sure.
Well, I got to say, I mean, even though you're embarrassed by it, I really think that the Google me bitch has some commercial potential as a trademark for you to register it. Because we had Bruce Buffer on before, and he advises people to do so, since he and his brother Michael have profited so handsomely from his Ready to Rumble catchphrase. And you know, it's something that you may want to consider, maybe t-shirts or something down the line. And I mean, like I said, you aren't proud of the incident, however it clearly wasn't your fault, and he was actually putting his hands on you and pushing you right from the get-go, which is obviously an assault.
Yeah, people have asked me if I wanted to make t-shirts and do all that kind of stuff, but my other profession outside of fighting is I'm a high school teacher.
Right.
So I don't know how well that would play out, having a Google me bitch line. But yeah, maybe somewhere down the road.
Yeah. Well, would your high school, would they give you problems, like if you were selling stuff like that online or whatnot? I don't know. I mean, I know teachers have to be very careful as far as, you know, anything they do outside of school with Facebook or any other type of activities out there.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't crossed that bridge yet, but
yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not my focus right now.
Yeah, I totally understand that. That's you know, understandable. I wanted to just to kind of talk about what you've got going on here now. As I mentioned, you are fighting for the Attachee Palace Fighting Organization, and if I'm not mistaken, you're also the bantamweight champion there. When is your next fight? Where are you now in terms of your career? Do you have any inclination to return to the UFC?
Yeah, that's kind of the goal right now, is to get back to the UFC. You know, I feel like I lost a couple close decisions. I won one fight, and then I lost that fight to Manny Gambarian. But I didn't get, you know, every fight was competitive, and it could have gone my way. You know, for one reason or another, it didn't. And, you know, since then, I went 3-0 last year and became the bantamweight champion for the Attachee Palace and then defended the title in my last fight. And for this fight, I'm fighting on May 18th at Attachee Palace Fights 31, and I'm actually moving up to 145 pounds to fight the champion to try to become a dual champion.
Yeah, that's right. You fought against Kyle Reyes. You defended your title successfully. And a lot of fighters are now trying to become two division champions, almost like, you know, Conor McGregor did that. Who are you fighting on the 18th?
We're fighting the featherweight champion's name is Adrian Diaz. He's a Team Alpha Male guy. And he's the featherweight champion. And really, it's about challenging myself. You know, I mean, there was no real clear fight for me at 135 at the moment. They're having a couple of contender fights at the show, actually, in May. It hopefully will clear up who I'm going to fight next for my bantamweight belt. But because there was no fight that really made a lot of sense, it's going to progress my career. I know I'm the one who kind of pressed to move up to 145s. And try to get a second belt. You know, I don't think I'll defend it necessarily. I'll probably just try to win the belt and then vacate it and go back to 135. That's really where I want to be fighting. It's the weight class I want to be fighting in. But, you know, Diaz is a good name in the California scene, and he's a Team Alpha Male guy. So you know, it just seemed like a good opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. I could definitely see it. Well, you want to take that opportunity and definitely see it pay dividends for you if you do win. Well, listen, Cody, thank you so much for your time tonight. I really appreciate it. As one of the most exciting and highly skilled fighters outside the UFC right now, I know the fans were eager to get an update from you about what's going on next and whatnot. Let's give people out at home your social media information so they can keep up with you directly.
I've got a Twitter. Pretty active on Twitter at the Renegade 559, and then same hashtag for Instagram, and then I've also got a Facebook fan page, so you could reach me on any of those. I'm pretty active on them.
Well, good luck in your journey back to the UFC, and good luck with being a teacher as well. I know that's a very, very difficult profession, but highly rewarding profession as well. So. I wish you both very, very good luck there in those endeavors. And thank you for joining us here on Carson's Corner.
Hey, I appreciate you having me. It was nice talking to you.
Take care, everybody. All right, that was Cody Gibson here on Carson's Corner. We got about 9 minutes left here on the program. It's almost 2 a.m. here Eastern Time. Can you believe that, folks? All right. I mentioned before we had Cody on the program about Conor McGregor. And Conor McGregor now apparently, according to reports, had drug paraphernalia in his hotel room. Now, he was seen partying with several of his guys while his wife is in Ireland about to give birth or something like that. Now, we should point out that it's not necessarily uncommon for someone who is about to have a child to go into a hotel room or something, or, you know, some of these guys that have money, they can go to Las Vegas and do God knows what behind closed doors with their friends, and really, really, you know, I guess take the stress off or whatever. I don't know. I'm not a father. I have no intentions of becoming a father, so I'll never. I guess I'll never know what it's like. But he really, really made a mess of this hotel room. And there's drug paraphernalia there. There's a nitrous oxide canisters there. And, you know, I got to tell you, this is, you know, you look at some of his other behavior, driving in these luxury cars and what do they call them, smoking vapes, vapors. You know, if some of the other, I know that there are some other female fighters or some female fighters that did that, and some other fighters, if Tyron Woodley did that and exhibited the behavior that, you know, someone like Michael Bisping or Conor McGregor does on a daily basis, there would be all hell to pay. So there seems to be a double standard, I think. I don't know. There seems to be a double standard in what certain fighters are allowed to do relative to other fighters. But what I think is happening here, and this is something I really, really fear, is that Conor McGregor is getting too big for his britches. He, you know, wants to fight Mayweather, and Dana White says that this fight is not close to have, although Dana White says that Conor can make $75 million and Floyd can make north of $100 million, depending upon how the pay-per-view sells. But what's happening is this guy, Conor McGregor, is almost getting too big or sees himself as too big for the UFC, and so therefore, you know, he doesn't have to fight. He doesn't have to defend his belt. And that's why I don't think this fight with Mayweather is a good idea, just from a MMA perspective out there, because it's only going to further tie up the division. And, you know, who knows when Conor's going to fight again, if he's going to fight again. It's just, they don't have any control over this guy anymore, you know. And this behavior that he's exhibiting on social media just kind of illustrates that. It really does. I mean, and Dana always says, oh, you know, I have a relationship with Conor. And I, you know, believe you got to pick and choose your battle. Not listen, Conor is winning the battle here because he's doing whatever the hell he wants to do. He's not fighting, and you know he's got the UFC now invested in this whole Conor versus Floyd matchup here. This fight, which has so many different things that have to be ironed out, and it's really, really unfortunate. And you know, I almost don't want to see this. You know, I don't really care about this. You know, do you care about seeing Conor McGregor fight Floyd Mayweather in boxing? I want to see Conor McGregor fight in MMA. I want to see Conor McGregor fight Tony Ferguson or, you know, Khabib, who may not fight forever for the rest of his life, or fill in the blank. I wouldn't mind seeing Conor McGregor fight Nate Diaz again, or take a trip to another weight division, a higher weight division, to fight Tyron Woodley. There's so many fights in MMA for Conor to fight and still be a draw, because he's really the last remaining UFC pay-per-view draw, that this whole thing is a fiasco. It's just an absolute joke. And I'll tell you, you know, Dana White has to get a hold of this guy, has to corral this guy. And I used to be, you know, very, very favorable as far as Conor McGregor using his leverage and deciding when he is and when he's not going to fight and whatnot, because he has stepped up. He has done a lot of things, and you can't doubt him as a great MMA fighter and a great champion. You know, before he fought Jose Aldo, a lot of people were like, who the hell is this guy? He's just talking his way into these fights. No, he beats Jose Aldo in 13 seconds. You know, he beat Eddie Alvarez handedly. He's beating these guys. He beat two champions in two different divisions. That's huge. And he beat Nate Diaz, even though even though he lost to Nate Diaz the first time. Nate Diaz, you know, 170 pounds. Okay, I mean, these are very, very big accomplishments. So he's worth the hype. You know, he's a draw for a reason. You know, just like Ronda was a draw for a reason. But that was then, this is now. You know, things and everything depreciates in this sport. People depreciate very, very quickly. And the fans, the MMA fans, and myself included, have a very, very short attention span. We want to see this guy fight. We don't care, you know, what happened 2 years ago or a year ago. You know, we want to see the best fights now. And we don't have to wait. We shouldn't have to wait for this crap. And so that's what I think this drug paraphernalia, even if it's not his, I doubt it's his. I would be really surprised if he's doing drugs. He's still being tested by USADA. He's still in competition. But you know what? Would it really surprise you if he does pop? If he pops for a drug, if he's even around people that are inhaling drugs, you know, he could test positive as well. It's happened before. So he's really putting himself at risk by engaging in this type of behavior. And if he does pop positive, then you know what? He's got to suffer the same consequences as everybody else, as a Lyoto Machida or any of these guys that get suspended, you know, when they're taking a supplement that's not properly labeled and whatnot. So real quickly, our good friend, it looks like Jerry Millen of Ryzen Fighting Federation is out of Ryzen Fighting Federation. I reached out to Jerry, said he's not able to comment this time. But Imaro Ranallo was pointing out that he was out. And so I'm guessing, I don't know if it has something to do with Moro's arrival in Ryzen Fighting Federation, if there's politics, or if Jerry left. I don't know what the situation is. But, you know, it appears that Jerry Millen is out as being the senior vice president of Ryzen Fighting Federation. And nobody's really reporting that, so this is kind of the first you're hearing this on Carson's Corner. So our big thanks to Cody Gibson. Really appreciate him coming on the program for nearly an hour. Really appreciate you, the fans, putting up with me and all the technical difficulties that we had in the first hour. Want to remind everybody to friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Also on twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. And follow me right here on Blog Talk Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.